finance. He worked for a trading house and was obsessed with the anecdotal aspects of the market. He once asked me doggedly what I thought the stock market would do that day. Clearly I gave him a social answer of the kind, I don't know, perhaps lower. Quite possibly the opposite answer to what I would have given him had he asked me an hour earlier. The next day he showed great alarm upon seeing me. He went on and on discussing my credibility, and wondering how I could be so wrong in my predictions since the market went up subsequently. The man was able to derive conclusions about my ability to predict and my credibility with a single observation. Now, if I went to the phone and called him and disguised my voice and said,
"Hello, this is Dr. Talebsky from the Academy of Lutz, and I have an interesting problem,"
then presented the issue as a statistical puzzle, he would laugh at me.
"Dr. Talebsky, did you get your degree in a fortune cookie?"
Why is it so? Clearly there are two problems. First, the quant did not use his statistical brain when making the inference, but a different one. Second, he made the mistake of overstating the importance of small samples, in this case just one single observation, the worst possible inferential mistake a person can make. Mathematicians tend to make egregious mathematical mistakes outside of their theoretical habitat. When Tversky and Kahneman sampled mathematical psychologists, some of whom were authors of statistical textbooks, they were puzzled by their errors. Respondents put too much confidence in the result of small samples, and their statistical judgment showed little sensitivity to sample size. The puzzling aspect is that not only should they have known better, they did know better. And yet, I will next list a few more heuristics. 1. The availability heuristic, which we saw in Chapter 3, with the earthquake in California deemed more likely than catastrophe in the entire country, or death from terrorism being more likely than death from all possible sources, including terrorism. It corresponds to the practice of estimating the frequency of an event, according to the ease with which instances of the event can be recalled. 2. The representativeness heuristic, gauging the probability that a person belongs to a particular social group by assessing how similar the person's characteristics are to the typical group members. A feminist-style philosophy student is deemed more likely to be a feminist bank teller than to be just a bank teller. This problem is known as the Linda problem. The feminist's name was Linda, and has caused plenty of academic ink to flow. Some of the people engaged in the rationality debate believe that Kahneman and Tversky are putting highly normative demands on us humans. 3. The simulation heuristic, the ease of mentally undoing an event, playing the alternative scenario. It corresponds to counterfactual thinking. Imagine what might have happened had you not missed your train, or how rich you'd be today had you liquidated your portfolio at the height of the NASDAQ bubble. And finally, 4. We discussed in Chapter 3 the effect heuristic. What emotions are elicited by events determine their probability in your mind. Two systems of reasoning. Later research refines the problem as follows. There are two possible ways for us to reason, the heuristics being part of one, rationality being part of the other. Recall the colleague who used a different brain in the classroom than the one in real life in Chapter 2. Didn't you wonder why the person you think knows physics so well cannot apply the basic laws of physics by driving well? Researchers divide the activities of our mind into the following two polarized parts, called System 1 and System 2. System 1 is effortless, automatic, associative, rapid, parallel process, opaque, i.e. we are not aware of using it, emotional, concrete, specific, social, and personalized. System 2 is effortful, controlled, deductive, slow, serial, self-aware, neutral, abstract, sets, asocial, and depersonalized. I have always believed that professional option traders and market makers, by dint of practicing their probabilistic game, build an innate probabilistic machine that is far more developed than the rest of the population, even that of probabilists. I found a confirmation of that as researchers in the heuristics and biases tradition believe that System 1 can be impacted by experience and integrate elements from System 2. For instance, when you learn to play chess, you use System 2. After a while, things become intuitive, and you are able to gauge the relative strength of an opponent by glancing at the board. Next, I introduce the evolutionary psychology point of view. Why we don't marry the first date. Another branch of research, called evolutionary psychology, developed a completely different approach to the same problem. It operates in parallel, creating some bitter but not so worrisome academic debates. These evolutionary psychologists agree with the Kahneman-Tversky school that people have difficulties with standard probabilistic reasoning. However, they believe that the reason lies in the way things are presented to us in the current environment. To them, we are optimized for a set of probabilistic reasoning, but in a different environment than the one prevailing today. The statement, "Our brains are made for fitness, not for truth," by the scientific intellectual Steven Pinker, the public spokesman of that school, summarizes it all. They agree that our brains are not made for understanding things, but think that they are not biased, or only biased because we do not use them in their real habitat. Strangely, the Kahneman-Tversky school of researchers did not incur any credible resistance from the opinions of the economists of the time. The general credibility of conventional economists has always been so low that almost nobody in science or in the real world ever pays attention to them. No, instead the challenge came from the sociobiologists, and the center of the disagreement lies in their belief in using evolutionary theory as a backbone for our understanding of human nature. While this caused a fierce scientific dispute, I will have to say that they agree on the significant part as far as this book is concerned. 1. We do not think when making choices, but use heuristics. And 2. We make serious probabilistic mistakes in today's world, whatever the true reason. Note that the split even covers the new economics. Just as we have a scientific branch of economics coming out of the Kahneman and Tversky tradition, behavioral economics, there is another scientific branch of economics coming out of evolutionary psychology, with the caveman economics approach, followed by such researchers as the economist-biologist Terry Burnham, co-author of the very readable Mean Genes. Our Natural Habitat. I will not delve too deeply into amateur evolutionary theory to probe at the reasons. Besides, in spite of having spent some time in libraries, I feel that I am truly an amateur in the subject matter. Clearly, the environment for which we have built our endowment is not the one that prevails today. I have not told too many of my colleagues that their decision-making contains some lingering habits of cavemen, but when markets experience an abrupt move, I experience the same rush of adrenaline as if a leopard were seen prowling near my trading desk. Some of my colleagues who break telephone handles upon losing money might be even closer in their psychological makeup to our common origin. This might be a platitude to those who frequent the Greek and Latin classics, but we never fail to be surprised when noticing that people a couple dozen centuries removed from us can exhibit similar sensibility and feelings. What used to strike me as a child upon visiting museums is that ancient Greek statues exhibit men with traits indistinguishable from ours, only more harmonious and aristocratic. I was so wrong to believe that 2,200 years was a long time. Proust wrote frequently about the surprise people have when coming across emotions in Homeric heroes that are similar to those we experience today. By genetic standards, these Homeric heroes of 30 centuries ago, in all likelihood, have the exact identical makeup as the pudgy, middle-aged man you see schlepping groceries in the parking lot. More than that, in fact, we are truly identical to the man who perhaps 80 centuries ago started being called civilized in that strip of land stretching from southeastern Syria to southwestern Mesopotamia. What is our natural habitat? By natural habitat, I mean the environment in which we reproduced the most, the one in which we spent the highest number of generations. The consensus among anthropologists is that we have been around as a separate species for 130,000 years, most of which were spent in the African savanna. But we do not have to go back that far in history to get the point. Imagine life in an early urban settlement in Middletown, Fertile Crescent, only about 3,000 years ago. Surely modern times, from a genetic standpoint. Information is limited by the physical means of its transmission. One cannot travel fast, hence, information will come from faraway places in concise batches. Traveling is a nuisance fraught with all manner of physical danger. You will settle within a narrow radius of where you were born unless famine or some invading uncivilized tribe dislodges you and your relatives from your happy settlement. The number of people you would get to know in a lifetime will be small. Should a crime be committed, it will be easy to gauge the evidence of guilt within the small number of possible suspects. If you are unjustly convicted of a crime, you will argue in simple terms, propounding simple evidence like, "I was not there as I was praying in the temple of Baal, and was seen at dusk by the high priest," and add that Obed-Shemesh, son of Sahar, was more likely to be guilty because he had more to gain from the crime. Your life would be simple, hence your space of probabilities would be narrow. The real problem is, as I have mentioned, that such a natural habitat does not include much information. An efficient computation of the odds was never necessary until very recently. This also explains why we had to wait until the emergence of the gambling literature to see the growth of the mathematics of probability. Popular belief holds that the religious backdrop of the first and second millennia blocked the growth of tools that hint at absence of determinism and caused the delays in probability research. The idea is extremely dubious. We simply did not compute probabilities because we did not dare to? Surely the reason is rather because we did not need to. Much of our problem comes from the fact that we have evolved out of such a habitat faster, much faster, than our genes. Even worse, our genes have not changed at all. Fast and frugal. Evolutionary theorists agree that brain work depends on how the subject is presented and the frame offered, and they can be contradictory in their results. We detect cheaters with a different part of our brain than the one we draw on to solve logical problems. People can make incoherent choices because the brain works in the form of small, partial jobs. These heuristics that we said were quick and dirty to the psychologists are fast and frugal to the evolutionary psychologists. Not only that, but some thinkers, like the cognitive scientist Gerd Gigerenzer, seem to have obsessively taken the other side of the trade from Kahneman and Tversky. His work and that of his associates at the ABC Group, Adaptive Behavior and Cognition, intend to show that we are rational and that evolution produces a form of rationality he calls ecological rationality. They believe that not only are we hardwired for optimizing probabilistic behavior in situations like mate selection, how many people of the opposite sex do you need to meet before pulling the trigger, or choosing a meal, but we are also so wired for stock selection, and that we do it appropriately if the stocks are presented to us in the correct manner. In fact, Gigerenzer agrees that we do not understand probability, too abstract, but we react rather well to frequencies, less abstract. According to him, some problems that normally would cause us to make a mistake disappear when phrased in terms of percentages. According to these researchers, while we may like to think of our brain as a central processing system with top-down features, an analogy to the Swiss Army knife with its small specific tools seems to be in order. How? The psychologist's framework is built around the distinction between the domain-specific and domain-general adaptations. A domain-specific adaptation is something that is meant to solve a very precise task, as opposed to domain-general ones that are meant to solve global ones. While these are easy to understand and accept for physiological adaptations, i.e., a giraffe's neck helps in reaching food, or an animal's colors in providing camouflage, people have had difficulties accepting why these apply to our mind in the same manner. Our brain functions by modules. An interesting aspect of modularity is that we may use different modules for different instances of the same problem, depending on the framework in which it is presented. One of the attributes of a module is its encapsulation, i.e., we cannot infer with its functioning, as we are not aware of using it. The most striking module is used when we try to find a cheater. Expressed in purely logical form, though with extreme clarity, a given quiz is only solved by 15% of the people to whom it is given. Now, the same quiz expressed in a manner that aims at uncovering a cheater, almost everyone gets it. Neurobiologists, too. Neurobiologists also have their side of the story. They believe, roughly, that we have three brains. The very old one, the reptilian brain that dictates heartbeat and that we share with all animals. The limbic brain center of emotions that we share with mammals. And the neurocortex, or cognitive brain, that distinguishes primates and humans. Note that even institutional investors seem to have a neocortex. While that theory of the triune brain shows some oversimplification, particularly when handled by journalists, it seems to provide a framework for the analysis of brain functions. Although it is very difficult to figure out which part of the brain does what exactly, neuroscientists have been doing some environment mapping in the brain by, say, taking a patient whose brain is damaged in one single spot, say by a tumor or an injury deemed to be local, and deducing by elimination the function performed by such part of the anatomy. Other methods include brain imaging and electric simulations to specific areas. Many researchers outside of neurobiology, like the philosopher and cognitive scientist Jerry Fodor, who pioneered the notion of modularity, remain skeptical about the quality of the knowledge that we can uncover by examining the physical properties of the brain, be it only on account of the complicated interactions of the single parts, with corresponding non-linearities. The mathematician and cognitive scientist David Marr, who pioneered the field of object recognition, made the apt remark that one does not learn how birds fly by studying feathers, but rather by studying aerodynamics. I will present the theses of two watershed works presented in readable books, Damasio's Descartes' Error and Ledoux's Emotional Brain. Descartes' Error presents a very simple thesis. You perform a surgical ablation on a piece of someone's brain, say to remove a tumor and tissue around it, with the sole resulting effect of an inability to register emotions. Nothing else. The IQ and every other faculty remain the same. What you have done is a controlled experiment to separate someone's intelligence from his emotions. Now you have a purely rational human being, unencumbered with feelings and emotions. Let's watch. Damasio reported that the purely unemotional man was incapable of making the simplest decision. He could not get out of bed in the morning, and frittered away his days fruitlessly weighing decisions. Shock! This flies in the face of everything one would have expected. One cannot make a decision without emotion. Now, mathematics gives the same answer. If one were to perform an optimizing operation across a large collection of variables, even with a brain as large as ours, it would take a very long time to decide on the simplest of tasks. So we need